If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest edition, the latest episode, the latest chapter of Life on Planet Porky. And we have had a bit of a technical drama, actually, before we have been able to get into our respective self-isolation studios this morning, which we'll tell you all about later. But luckily, between us, we managed to resolve it. So I'm delighted to be able to say a very big hello to Leslie Ann Jones.
Here we are again, overcoming all the trials and tribulations of lockdown.
Indeed.
In some ways, it feels like we're still in lockdown, doesn't it?
Well, it does a bit, yeah. And I've tried to go into a couple of pubs in the past 3 or 4 days, and I've stopped at the door, to be honest. I'm still very, very nervous about going in there. Don't mind going into a pub that's big and airy and spacious in the middle, but some pubs, you know, because of the design of them, they're older and all that, you have to go down a very narrow channel between seats on the right and the bar on the left to get to a space at the back, and that's the bit I don't like. But you're absolutely right. I hope it'll come back sooner rather than later, but it doesn't feel like we're all free just yet. Now, let me just reveal to the audience, Leslie Ann, that we've had a bit of a problem with a microphone. What exactly happened in this magnificent drama?
Oh, a very simple thing. You know, I knocked the microphone off its stand. It fell over.
Oh, my God.
And the connection at the back just broke. Mm. I mean, and so then I had to pull the troops in to action.
Yeah.
The sort of giant Jones Shine Brigade.
Yes.
Came to my rescue, my son being a singer, brought in, shipped in all his own recording equipment and has set me up again. So good to go, Mike.
Absolutely good to go. The story I most like about microphone is I was doing a case in New York involving Mick Jagger. And at the time, the Stones had a legal action against, was it Alan Klein, the bloke who tried?
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was the manager for a while.
Yeah, after Brian Epstein died and all that. And the judge was completely overwhelmed, right? And so Mick Jagger took the stand and the judge leaned forward and said, Mr. Jagger, thank you very much for joining us in the Manhattan Supreme Court this morning. He says, may I remind you, when you want to make yourself heard, you lean forward and you speak into that device there, Mr. Jagger. That is a microphone. And Jagger just nodded his head. And then the judge said, do you have much experience with microphones, Mr. Jagger? Ha, 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 ha. You know, the judge thought he was being hilariously funny with the world's most famous rock star at the time. But I'm sure the judge enjoyed it. Talking about,
I think that's the sense of humour of the American judiciary does not really cross over with that of the average rock star.
No, it doesn't actually. But Mick Jagger humoured him by grinning, you know, because obviously he wanted to win the case and he wanted the judge on his side. Talking about rock stars, just want to tell you about a little story picked up since I last spoke to you. Have you ever had many dealings with Noel Gallagher?
No, not really. They've been a bit standoffish over the years. But
yeah,
you always have to remember that I was kind of out of covering rock and pop music by the 90s. So, you know, I wasn't still gadding around going to all the festivals and the shows and interviewing artists come that time because I'd moved on to become an author by then.
Yes, no, sure. I understand that. Absolutely. No, the reason I ask is that I've met him a couple of times when he's come into our radio station, usually late at night, you know, and done pieces because he's a very, very big Manchester City fan as well. So obviously working at a station called Talk Sport, it's terrific to get a guy like Noel Gallagher on talking very, you know, lucidly and very knowledgeably about football. But I've always liked his attitude in life. He doesn't really care about anybody, including his own brother, you know. So I picked up this piece this morning that he's out somewhere in London, somewhere quite swanky, and he gets a tap on the shoulder. And he turns around, and he's quite approachable. He's not a problem. And he says, yeah, how can I help you? And the person who tapped her on the shoulder said, I just wanted to let you know that Adele's in the building. Would you like an introduction to her? Yeah. Can you imagine his reaction?
Well, probably it was two words and the second one began with O.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And he just said, you know, what do people think I am? He said it happened to him once before when he was in the Chiltern Firehouse. Have you been to the Chiltern Firehouse?
Yeah, it's a bit average. I always think it's massively overrated. There are better restaurants.
Well, it's called the Chiltern Firehouse, apparently, because it used to be a fire station, didn't it? And now all the great and the good go there, don't they, all the time?
I don't know why. I mean, also they had issues in their kitchen with hygiene and rodents running about and stuff like that. And the food isn't, you know, wildly better than anywhere else that I've been that's said to be, you know, the best restaurant in the world.
Yeah, well, I've never been there. I don't like mixing in those places because I just feel... Oh, I don't know, everybody's there to pose, really, you know what I mean, rather than anything else. But anyway, Noel Gallagher was in the Chiltern Firehouse and he gets another tap on the shoulder and a person says, oh, hello, you're Noel Gallagher, aren't you? And he said, yes, you know, what's your problem? And this person said, we have the actress Carrie Fisher in the house tonight. Would you like an introduction to her?
And he said...
Well, it was more along the lines of who's Carrie Fisher, you know what I mean, rather than everything else. He said he gets it. It happens all the time. He said there's very few people in the world who I would actually get up from my table and go over and say hello to. So he just said, Carrie Fisher, oh, I see, an actress. Nah, you're all right, mate. Thanks very much for the thought, you know, and then they just went off.
I think a lot of the time it is that these sort of fading stars would like to have their photograph taken with somebody who's current.
Yeah.
Because that picture would make its way to the papers.
Yes.
And then that would give them a bit more credibility that they've kind of lost over the years.
Yeah.
But they haven't got the courage to go and ask themselves.
Yes, I know.
Because they are rejected. So they get some minion to go and do it.
Yeah.
And even funnier when the guy says no.
Yes, that's right. I had to, there was one time I was at a sports dinner and it was at Lord's Cricket Club and it was in the long room at Lord's. I mean, you know, you're talking here about a temple of sport, you know what I mean? It's where the England cricketers walk through before they go out onto the pitch at Lord's, the world's most famous cricket venue. And it was a Jaguar-sponsored one, like the Jaguar Sports Academy. And I was sitting next to a female athlete, okay, on my table. And one table away was a table of real stars, including Ian Botham, right? And this female athlete lady said that she had members of her family, you know, her father and her brother and all that, who idolised Ian Botham. And would I go over and ask him to sign a menu for her? So I said, well, what's the point of me going over? You know,
you're doing yourself.
I said, you're much more famous than me in the sports world. You know, you've been a very successful athlete. Well, and she said, no, I can't. I'd wilt, you know. So I said, okay, I will. And I went over and I didn't know both of them. I think I'd met him once, you know, many years before, but only very, very casually, very passing. And he showed complete and total disinterest in wanting to talk to me. I don't blame him because, you know, it's very amateurish to go to a sports dinner like that full of stars and then asking people for autographs and all that. But I explained to him. I said, look, and I'm really sorry. And I explained who I was. He said, oh, yeah, we've spoken on the over the airways, haven't we? I said, yes, we have. I've had a couple of times promoting your charities. He said, well, that's fine. And I explained to him. He said, well, just go and ask her to come over. I said, I haven't got a problem with it at all. So I went back to my table and she was delighted and went over. But she really should have gone over first thing. You know what I mean?
Do you know what? I've never understood this thing about getting autographs.
Yeah.
I mean, what does that mean? Years later, you pull out some item or a book of people's signatures and you look at it. What does that really do for you? 9 times out of 10, you can't even recognise
the
signature. You can't tell who signed it in the first place. I just don't see the point. And because people tend to nowadays gather these autographs, these signatures, so that they can sell them on the internet.
That's right.
Or put them straight on eBay or something.
Yeah.
The only exception I make is signed copies of people's books, which I think is a really nice thing to have.
So do I.
And I never have a problem, obviously, with signing copies of my own.
No, exactly. I totally agree with you that. Do you know what? During lockdown, of course, everybody decluttered and all that. And I went through boxes and drawers of stuff that I'd accumulated over the years. And what you've just said actually hits the nail on the head. I found about three or four menus from sports dinners, you know, or things that we'd done at sort of the Epsom Derby or something like that. And it's signed, and I haven't got a clue who signed them. You're absolutely right. I have no idea. The only one I found, which I was very pleased about, I think I might have told you this, was Neville Southall got the OBE from the Queen, and the guy who went along representing the organisation I was working for, I asked him to get Neville Southall to sign the list, and he did, but it clearly says Neville Southall. Most autographs are indecipherable. That's the problem. You can't tell who signed it.
No, and people seem to think they have worth of some kind, but yeah. People study these things now, you know, nowadays. They will look at how Paul McCartney signs his name, and they will study that and copy it, and you're never going to know for sure whether you've got the genuine item if you happen to collect that kind of thing.
I totally agree.
I just don't see the point.
I've got football shirt signed by Wayne Rooney, but it's on a Wayne Rooney shirt. David Beckham, but it's on a David Beckham England shirt. And, you know, items which actually bear some resemblance to their profession and what they do. What you just said about Beatles autographs, by the way, I read only in the last few weeks, I meant to tell you this, that somebody was reminiscing about a meeting with George Harrison. And it was when George Harrison was at the BBC. And it was nothing to do with the Beatles. It was the fact that George Harrison took an interest in motor racing after the Beatles had broken up. I think that was quite well known, wasn't it? You know,
quite a few rock stars are into cars, you know, racing cars,
that's right.
Because they can afford it.
Yeah, he was at the BBC, right, talking to someone about motor racing when a mate of mine walked in who was doing the following show, and he was absolutely boggle-eyed, you know, because, like me, he'd grown up in the Beatles era. So he said to George, he found something that was relevant, maybe went down to the library and got a picture of George Harrison or something and said, could you sign this for me? And George Harrison said, without thinking, he said, sure. Do you just want mine or do you want them all?
And that's a great story.
And Derek, who was the guy I'm talking about, who in my mind said, what do you mean? He said, over the years, we had to all learn how to do each other's signatures because otherwise we'd have all spent far too much time passing around the same bits of paper, you know. So I don't know if that's widely known, is it?
Well, I think it's common. You know, Freddie Mercury had a member of staff who always sat and signed all their merchandise. He's right. They couldn't possibly have had the time to sign thousands and thousands of items.
Yeah.
So they always get other people to do their signatures.
Well, I know David Beckham, for instance, he was in demand at the height of his fame so much. He had a team of people led by his sister, I think, who actually had to, what they said was, process all the demands for identities. You know what I mean? And I suppose that's a nicer way of putting it. But I've got a Beckham signed shirt, which I swear is the genuine one because I got it from my friend at the FA and she saw him sign it. So that's my story and I'm sticking to it. Now, talking about fame and celebrities and all that, I want to talk to you, Leslie Ann, about an event that must have been one of the highlights of your already glittering career. And that was Live Aid, because this week is the 35th anniversary.
It's amazing, isn't it? It's like all these sort of moments in the distant past. It seems like both ancient history and only yesterday.
Yeah.
Because I can remember so much about it. I was there on the side of the stage and I'd gone to Live Aid with John Entwistle of The Who and his girlfriend, actually.
Right.
I'd stayed with them the night before in their house in Roehampton.
Oh, yeah.
And John had a Rolls Royce that he'd had converted into a sort of estate car.
Can you
imagine a Rolls Royce estate? Right. They don't actually make a Rolls Royce estate, but he had his converted so that he could carry his Irish wolfhound around in the back of it.
Good God.
The dog was called Fitz Perfectly. It was a gigantic thing. Yeah. On its hind legs, it was bigger than man.
Golly.
And I had to ride in the back of the car.
With the dog?
With the dog in the boot.
Well, you and the dog in the cage, so to speak.
Me and the dog in the cage, yeah. That was the only place for me.
Yeah.
When we got to Wembley Stadium car park, Kenny Jones, the drummer, was there. And as we jumped out, he said, "You let the dogs out," which wasn't very nice.
No, that's a bit harsh. Yeah,
Kenny, if you're listening. But it was an amazing day. it backstage was such an interesting place to be.
Well, I bet it was. I mean, that was the famous Bob Geldof, you know, just give us the fucking money, wasn't it?
Well, he was up in the studio, up sort of in the stand somewhere.
Right.
And he was jumping between the TV studio and the stand where Charles and Diana were.
Yeah.
And backstage where there were all these sort of little trailers, like wagon trains, all pointing into a sort of circle.
Yeah.
And there was a branch of the Hard Rock Cafe there, which was meant to be feeding the artists all day long.
Right.
But Elton John didn't fancy this. So he had a little barbecue he was cooking up in the corner.
Yeah.
David Bailey was back there. He had a little makeshift studio in one stinky corner.
And
everybody had left their egos at home. That was the interesting thing. They were all mucking in.
Right.
Queen were a bit like a divorcing couple at the same party. You know, they weren't really talking to each other that day, shall we say.
But they stole the show in the end, didn't they?
Well, they did. But Freddie Mercury had his boyfriend, Jim Hutton, with him.
Right.
Not only was it Jim's first stadium gig, it was his first ever gig. He'd never been to see a live band before.
Right.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
That's throwing someone in at the deep end,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah.
But it was an extraordinary day, and I think, yeah, Queen did steal it. You're right. Yeah. Nobody can remember who went on before Queen. Nobody can remember who came on after Queen. You wouldn't want to be the ones who came on after Queen.
No.
But all kinds of little things happened. Like they had their sound guy go out front just before they went on stage.
Yeah.
And he whacked the sound up. So Queen were louder than everybody else.
Right.
And backstage, just as they started to play, everybody stopped talking and looked towards the monitors as if to say, who's making this sound?
Yeah.
It was extraordinary.
Yeah, I see.
But there was a magic, a total magic about that day.
Yeah.
And it wasn't anybody's gig. It wasn't anybody's audience.
Yeah.
Everybody was there for a sort of common reason.
Yes.
To raise money to feed the starving millions in Ethiopia.
It was Woodstock Revisited. I mean, it was a huge celebration. It was fantastic. What about getting away from Wembley that night?
Well, we all went in back in the converted.
But it must have taken ages. I mean,
well, it did. Yeah, John wasn't very happy with the Who's performance. I think the sound had failed at the start of their set.
Right.
He wasn't too happy with how they came across, and he wasn't in the mood to party. Everybody else was going off to the Embassy Club in town and to Legends.
Right.
And John didn't want to do that, so we just went back to their house.
Yeah.
But I think, we managed to get away. Okay.
Yeah, I've been to so many big games at the old Wembley Stadium. It was always a nightmare getting away. It's a nightmare now, Wembley. That's the big problem. That's why I'm sometimes reluctant to go unless it's really worthwhile going. It's not the getting there, because you get there early, because I've always got a table at a lunch or something like that. But it's the damn getting away afterwards. And so I normally leave 5 minutes before the end of the game now and rush to the station. But there we are. Now,
I'll tell you where you don't want to go for a concert is the O2. Because it can take 3 or 4 hours to get out of there.
I totally agree. Absolutely hopeless. And unless you're in corporate and you've got somewhere to go for an hour afterwards, it's really hopeless. I totally agree. Now, Leslie Ann, we have told our millions of listeners the slight technical hitch before the show started. It was resolved by, amongst others, your son, of course. And I saw you put out a tweet 24 or 36 hours ago, in which you got slightly irritated by the fact that young Marcus Rashford, who's 22, has been given an honorary degree by a university. I think it's Salford or Manchester or one of them. And your irritation is that, you know, people like your son and your daughter have worked many, many years to get a proper degree.
Well, look at the blood, sweat, tears it takes to earn a degree.
Yeah.
For me, an honorary degree makes a mockery of young people who've had to toil to get theirs, you know. I have nothing against him. I think he's an admirable young man. And for all the work he's been doing, it's very special. Does it really warrant the award of an honorary degree? I'm not sure it does.
Yeah.
Lots of famous people down the years have been given them. Annie Lennox got one a few years ago. David Bowie was awarded.
Yes.
Shouldn't they have earned their own at the right time when everybody takes their degrees? You know, I just think it takes the heat out of it for those who have really slogged to earn them.
Yeah, I don't think a footballer needs an honorary degree for what he's done. I totally agree with you. I think reward enough is the adulation that's been heaped upon him, you know, for, you know, what a wonderful thing. He's changed government policy, 22-year-old multimillionaire footballer giving something back to the community. And I really wonder whether it's the university looking to get more out of that than Marcus Rashford.
Yeah, well, there's the rub, you know, because it's shining a light on the university, isn't it?
Yes.
And on his sort of local community. Nothing wrong with that. But for me, there must be another way of recognizing his achievement. Yeah. We have an honours system in this country. They don't have that in very many countries, but we do. You can get an MBE, an OBE, a CBE, a knighthood, whatever. Surely something like that would have been more appropriate to recognise his achievements.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. Having said that, I must admit, I harbour a deep-seated wish that somebody from the University of Chester, which is my hometown, is going to contact me. I'm still waiting for the letter to drop through the door. To say they want to award me an honorary degree for shining the light on Chester and for being one of their most famous citizens of the modern era. I'm not the most famous. The most famous is Money Supermarket Man. What's his name? Martin Lewis, isn't it? Is it Martin?
Oh, yeah.
But
the finance guy.
Yeah, the finance guy. Yeah, he went to my school. He went to the King's School Chester like I did. We're both in the Hall of Fame at the entrance to the school. But of course, he's done an awful lot better than me. The other guy who's close is Daniel Craig, James Bond, obviously, but he comes from a place called Ellesmere Port, which is about 7 or 8 miles away and within the borough of within the boundaries of Merseyside, whereas we are very proud Sestrians. But I think I might start a campaign with a local paper, the Chester Chronicle, which I used to work for them to demand that Mike Porky Parry gets an award from Chester University. Do wonders for Chester University, because it used to be a teacher's training college, but like all things in the last 25 years that were technical colleges or teacher's training colleges, they're now amazingly a university. But, you know, there's too many universities in this country already. Anyway.
Well, I think you're pulling my leg, because I think that you wouldn't actually accept an honorary degree. You've got a degree anyway.
I haven't.
Oh, I thought you had.
No, I did 1 year at the University of the Trent and then copped out because I realised that trying to become a chartered surveyor wasn't really my calling. And that's when I left and went and joined the Chester Chronicle, and the rest, of course, is history. I conquered Fleet Street, conquered the airwaves, and now, of course, greatest accolade of all, I'm working with you.
It's, you know, for me too, it's just, this is the highlight of my life.
Absolutely.
But, you know, if you really desperately need a degree, Mike, you could work for one with the Open University.
I could do, but that would take too long. I've thought about buying one from somebody in America, because of course that's easy enough.
Well, you can buy a knighthood, you can buy yourself into royalty in America, of course.
No, exactly. I totally agree. You certainly can. Just talking about education, all that kind of stuff. Moving on to Fleet Street, really. I see The Guardian are shedding an awful lot of jobs, and I'm not gloating here at all. I've never been a great fan of The Guardian, but they're shedding 180 jobs. The group that controls Mirror, Express and Star has announced they're shedding 350 jobs. I mean, these are hard, hard times, Leslie-Ann, for the industry that you and I worked in when it was largely at its peak production.
I think we have to accept that print newspapers are on the way out.
Yep.
Ad revenue is down. Circulation is down. The internet killed our industry.
Yes, it did.
And then there's corporate ownership, there's social media, you know, losses in revenue. You can now read an article with the click of a finger or a little tap. You don't have to go down the road, buy a paper. I think the most significant thing is that papers are not breaking the news anymore.
No.
They follow it, because we're getting news 24/7.
That's right.
By switching on the television or our laptop.
So
the role of newspapers has changed. They've become magazines, really. They follow up stories.
Yeah.
And they're largely photographic. My kids never read a paper.
No.
You know, that says everything, doesn't it? So our generation is clinging on.
Yeah.
But I think within 5 years, we won't see print newspapers anymore.
I think you might see two. You know, I think there might be one quality paper, which I would say would probably be The Times.
The Times.
Got huge resources behind it. And you'll see one tabloid paper, and that might be The Sun, because, again, they've got huge resources behind them. The one in the middle, the Daily Mail, is also very well resourced, but they're a company which are not just reliant on newspapers. They're not just a media company, you know. They've got, like, show event companies and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, look, we'll have to see. Just before we leave Fleet Street, I'm very sorry to read of the passing of an old colleague of mine called Clive Limkin, a photographer, described as veteran Fleet Street photographer. Do you remember him by any chance? He's a lot older than you.
I did work with him a few times because he was on the Daily Mail after he left the Express.
He was.
He did about 20 years at the Mail, and we did cross over.
Yeah.
He was famous at the Mail for his royal pictures.
Oh, really?
He took some fantastic pictures of Diana and Fergie and Diana with the boys and so on.
Yeah.
But, of course, his most famous picture was the boy in the gas mask with the petrol bomb, wasn't it?
That's right.
During the whole Battle of the Bogside.
Yeah.
So he did say as well, I never got a better picture in my entire career. He was a classic old school Fleet Street photographer. And may he rest in peace.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I met him in Ireland. My first real sort of overseas kind of mission was being sent to Ireland to cover the Troubles for the Daily Express. I mean, I'd done loads of things terrorists blowing up beaches in Spain and all that when I worked on the Birmingham Mail, when there were, you know, Birmingham holidaymakers over there. But the actual real story was being sent to Ireland. I was there for in and out there for 18 months. And that's where I first met Clive. In Londonderry, we used to stay at the Everglades Hotel. In Belfast, we stayed at the Europa. We were out every night in riots, dodging petrol bombs, going off to photograph craters that had been, you know, blown into the road, trying to kill British Army soldiers. It was a fascinating and terrifying sort of time. And Clive was, honestly, he was a very calming influence. A lot of people, you know, got nervous and erratic in that sort of atmosphere. He always stayed very cool.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you for being with us today. I'm with Leslie Ann Jones, of course. Leslie Ann, we talk endlessly about the Beatles for a couple of reasons. Firstly, my favourite ever group. Secondly, you've written the book that's going to define John Lennon, Who Killed John Lennon, coming out later this year. We don't often talk about the Stones, although, funny enough, we did relay an anecdote about Mick Jagger earlier on in this podcast. But I thought I'd just let you know that on this day in the 60s, I can't remember which year it was, I think it was 63, the Stones got their first ever hit, It's All Over Now. Because I used to love her, ba-bam-bam, but it's all over now. Do you think the Stones in any way ever matched the impact that the Beatles had?
Well, they did for a moment, didn't they? And they've left
still
a legacy.
Going, aren't they?
Yeah, of course, but they don't really make new music. You know, if you go and see the Stones, you want them to play the hits from your childhood, pretty much.
Yeah.
People want Brown Sugar. They want Honky Tonk Women. They don't want any new compositions. And this has been their sort of, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it? They would like to still be a relevant band going out there and playing the latest album.
Yeah, but they still
tour.
Nobody
wants it.
They still tour and sell out, you know, giant stadiums, don't they? I mean,
yes, they do, but they're dinosaurs. They're a bunch of rusty tanks sort of rolling out across
the world.
I think
you'd be very unfair.
Looking for a war to go to.
Well, that's very unfair because they've still got millions of fans around the world. They must have to still be filling stadiums across America and Australia and everywhere.
I'm not disputing that.
Yeah.
But people go along for a nostalgia kick. They don't want the new stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, well, no, I totally agree. But who wants new stuff? Billy Joel said, we said this before. I heard Billy Joel in an interview. He said, no, I love doing live stuff. He said, I wouldn't dream of getting onto stage and playing some records that my audience hadn't heard of 20 or 30 years ago. All they want to hear are the old classics, and that's what I play them. And I can perfectly understand that. Now, look, I'm going to have a rant for a minute on what I consider to be a serious subject. I've got a headline here out of this morning's paper. Tobacco giants to pick up cost of clearing their litter. The tobacco industry could be forced to pay for the cost of cleaning up cigarette butts and packets under the government plans to tackle litter. I say, yes, more power to your elbow. It's about time this was done. Of course the tobacco companies should be responsible for the millions of empty fag packets littering our streets and the tens of millions of filthy, ashy butts which are ground into our pavements every day.
Well, of course it's an excellent idea. This took way too long coming. Yeah. But let's take it a bit further. What about getting these tobacco companies to pay the NHS for the treatment that these smokers are receiving for their self-inflicted illnesses?
Well, it's not illegal to smoke. I know what you mean. But you see, this is a complicated equation because it's part of the economy selling cigarettes. They generate huge profits for the companies and huge revenues in taxes for the government. So you can't just wipe it out like that. And it's a bit like saying, well, let's charge the breweries for the damage that's caused to people who drink alcohol. But the same equation applies, doesn't it?
Well, yes, of course it does. But why should all of us who pay our taxes into the NHS, which is what keeps the NHS afloat, why are we paying to save the lives of people who've damaged their own health?
Yeah. No, I totally agree. That's one I haven't got a definitive answer for because during my life, I've always been a heavy social drinker. I've never really had to rely on the NHS as a consequence, although some would say, well, you were in hospital for 7 months with a failed heart, which is true. But I think the evidence is conclusive that the reason that I suffered acute heart failure and still carry a disease called dilated cardiomyopathy is because my father died of it and I inherited it from him. I don't think it, you know, I haven't got cirrhosis of the liver from abuse to alcohol or anything like that, but I'm probably making excuses. But the litter thing is one that I feel so passionately about. You know, I go out two or three mornings a week outside my apartment in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey, and I have a pair of cellophane gloves on, which I've stolen from the petrol station, which they hand out to, you know, to use the petrol pumps. And I pick any loose litter up that's lying around for a good 100 yards either way outside my sort of driveway. And most of it are, well, it's all cans, plastic bottles, but loads and loads of discarded cigarette packets. It's such a thoughtless thing to do. Never mind being disgusting and filthy. I don't know how anybody can throw a piece of litter on the street, and we've got to educate people into not doing it.
Well, people are animals, aren't they? I mean, the recent scenes on the beaches where,
you know,
during the sunny days during lockdown, when people are leaving far worse than litter all over the beaches. How do you educate people if they don't understand that it's a disgusting, disgraceful thing to do?
Yes.
What hope is there? You know, because they know that there are not cameras on every inch of street watching them discard all this stuff. Mm. So they just chuck it. The ones who annoy me are the guys who wind down their windows and drop them out of their cars.
Absolutely disgraceful. I totally agree.
But, you know, if it were made law that if your illness is self-inflicted, that the NHS would no longer treat you for nothing, and that you would have to pay privately to have your illness dealt with, don't you think that a lot of people would give up smoking and drinking so heavily?
No, I don't. I just think they'd get on with it, honestly. I mean, you know, we were in a profession where, I mean, we worked in Fleet Street when Fleet Street was floated on a lake of wine, okay? And
yes, it was.
It was.
Hallelujah, it was.
Hallelujah, it was. And we knew. Did you ever meet a journalist who ever said, oh, I'm going to go a bit easy on this because, you know, I'm a bit worried about my health? That was never a consideration, and it never would be, even if there wasn't the National Health Service. I remember being in the Popinjay in Fleet Street when we were still in the Fleet Street office, and there was we had a columnist called John Acas. Don't know if you ever...
I remember him,
Yeah, well, he's got a son, actually, called somebody else Acas, who I worked with.
Funnily enough.
Yeah, years later. But John himself, he was a typical Fleet Street slop. He was a columnist and a political analyst, right? So these guys didn't have any deadlines. So they spent all day in the pub, literally. And he came in one Sunday to, you know, write a column or something like that. And on the Monday, I was asked by the landlady of the Popinjay, oh, hi, mate, do you know if John's going to be in today? I said, I don't know why. She said, well, he left yesterday without paying his bill, because he used to do that all the time. I said, oh, I'll sort it for you and I'll get it off John. 14 large gin and tonics over lunchtime on a Sunday.
Oh, God, that would have killed me.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah. And also, John was a smoker. You could smoke in the pubs in those days. So he'd always come back from lunch with ash all over his jacket, his tie, his shirt. He was just a complete Fleet Street slob, you know what I mean, who smoked about 80 fags a day and drank those huge volumes of gin. So I don't think John would ever have turned around and said, I'm going to worry about my health from now on. It just wouldn't happen. And you knew
well, that is a lost cause. That's a lost cause, that kind of guy.
Yeah.
But the factor in our case is that we were very young.
Yes, that's true.
At the time. And so, you know, we had health on our side,
yeah.
I suppose, when we were drinking so heavily. But I gave up drinking when I was pregnant with my first daughter.
Yes.
And I never regained the same capacity after I resumed. I never had the same tolerance for alcohol.
Right. Okay. Well, my tolerance for alcohol has withered over the years. I used to be a very resilient drinker. I could drink all night till 2 or 3 in the morning and then get up 3 hours later and go back into a studio and do a show. That's how we lived, you know. But since my heart went, I cut my drinking by 2/3 and then it grew back a little bit, but I still can't do it. And I'm glad I can't. I don't want to, you know, just keep causing problems by over-drinking, but there we go. Now, when we were talking last night about doing this, I said to you, I'm going to talk to you about Riverdance, okay? Because I saw in one of the glossy magazines, Riverdance 25, that's 25 years since Riverdance started, and announcing a new tour of Britain next year, that is 2021. So I want to formally invite you to join me at a Riverdance concert, Leslie Ann, because I love Riverdance. What about you?
How delightful of you, Michael.
Yes.
You're inviting me out. That's such a lovely thing.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Indeed.
I'd be very happy to accept. I did see Riverdance back in 1995. I took my eldest daughter when she was just a little girl.
Yeah.
And I'm absolutely blown away by it. I thought he was extraordinary, Michael Flatley. And the whole scenario on stage, you know, there was so much energy going on.
Yes.
All that incredible dancing with only the legs and the feet moving.
Yes.
The rest
right.
of the body not moving at all. It's quite a concept, that thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's absolutely fantastic. Now, that was last night. So I wake up this morning and I'm checking all my usual stats and facts and everything before we get going. And guess what? It's Michael Flatley's 62nd birthday today. What a massive coincidence, yeah.
Well, happy birthday, Michael Flatley, if you're listening.
Indeed. Now, I love Michael Flatley. I love him for his arrogance. I love him for his enormous ability. I mean, when you're watching Riverdance, I've still got the original tape. I can't play it on anything because I'm going to tape recorder these days. I'm going to try and get it put onto a DVD. But the opening to that, when all these beautiful girls in these green dresses are, you know, tapping away on the stage, and then all of a sudden the stage is deserted. Michael Flatley comes rushing onto the stage like a tornado in a white frilly shirt and his tight trousers, and he's spinning around like a spinning top, something I'd never seen before in my life. I thought the energy was incredible. But then later on, halfway through the show, he appears on the edge of the stage and he's playing the flute. And I looked up, you know, what his qualifications for that were, and apparently he's one of the world's great flautists.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah. I think probably flautist is the word you're reaching for.
Flautist, that's the word I'm looking for, yes, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, that conjures up all kinds of images.
Yes, exactly.
You've just burst his bubble.
Well, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. But anyway, yeah, go on.
Hilarious.
So he's apparently like a world-class musician as well. But what I really, what really impressed me about the guy was when he fell, I mean, he danced with a lady called Jean Butler, right?
Yeah.
And they hated each other, right?
They always hate each other.
No,
they probably ate garlic, raw garlic, before they went on and danced together.
These two literally hated each other, according to the reports I read assiduously, you know, when I became a Riverdance fan. And she was American. He was kind of Irish-American, and they didn't get on. And he was very outgoing. She was very private and all that kind of stuff. So in the end, he ended up leaving. But when he left, he didn't just walk away and start another one, you know, Feet of Fire or something, I think it was called, or Lord of the Dance, was it? Lord of the Dance.
Lord of the Dance, yeah.
Lord of the Dance, like that. He actually then went back and launched a legal action against Riverdance, claiming that he had the intellectual property rights because he had choreographed a lot of it. I mean, that's very clever stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, and he's right. You know, he did. He did create the whole phenomenon of Riverdance.
Yeah.
Because up until then, this form of dancing was restricted to the nation of Ireland. You know, it's their national dance.
Yeah.
And nobody had thought to take that out there in the world and to make something uniquely entertaining with it until he came along.
Didn't they start off as a 4-minute interval break act at the Eurovision Song Contest in Dublin?
Yeah, I think that's correct.
Yeah, I think they did. And somebody picked on it and thought, God, this is great. The other thing I liked was all the girls in Riverdance were picked not just for their dancing talent, they were picked for how good looking they were. They were absolutely beautiful, mesmerizing watching those girls dance.
And the footwork is so intricate, yes, isn't it? And it's mind-boggling to watch, really.
Yeah.
But it takes years of training, obviously, to get that good. And they start like little ballerinas start. You know, they start at the age of 2 or 3.
Right, yeah.
And they take part in local competitions, yep, and so on. They go around the country, you know, much as they do in Wales, in the Eisteddfod.
Yeah.
They have similar sort of localised things organised, sure, across Ireland.
Yeah.
This is where they all begin, when they're tiny little children. Flatley himself always reminded me a bit of Van Morrison.
Yeah.
You know, as you said, arrogant and swaggering, yeah, and didn't care and sort of stormed in like a bull in a china shop.
Yeah.
And he had that personality to carry the whole thing off. So Riverdance was him, and he had every right to the intellectual property of that, yeah, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I think he's very, very wealthy now for that reason, but good and successful people should be wealthy if they achieve what he's achieved. The other thing is that really turned me on was that I think there's about 3 times as many women in Riverdance as there are men. And Michael Flatley said there was an awful lot of testosterone flying around after every performance. And he said, yes, a lot of it went on. So it must have been quite a good place for a bloke to have worked in those days, I would imagine.
Well, do you remember, obviously, Richard Branson, when he ran Virgin Records, there was a rumour in the industry, yeah, and I don't know whether it's true, but that he had slept with every female on his staff. And I heard a similar rumour about Michael Flatley, actually.
Really?
Maybe that's part of the audition process.
Maybe it was part of the audition process. I mean, we all remember the Virgin Airways advert celebrating 25 years, I think, when those beautiful girls marching through the street with their captain at the helm, you know what I mean? And undoubtedly, I think ladies who worked for Virgin were largely picked for their looks. I think I've got to put a legal apology in the way about Mr. Branson, whether or not he did actually consort with all the female members of his staff. If he didn't, Mr. Branson, very sorry. But I'm sure it's a popular myth, which I don't think Richard Branson would be too upset, would he?
I think he would like the idea, well, that we all think that he was such a Lothario.
Oh, well, there you go. I'm not sure about his family, that's all. But no, I'm sure you're right. Now, listen, let me ask you this, Leslie-Anne. Of course, Land of My Fathers is Land of Your Father and Land of Your Heart, that's Wales. I didn't know anything about a place called the Rockfield Studio until I saw a mini documentary on it a couple of days ago saying it's closing down, but It's on some sort of sheep farm in a remote part of Wales where some of the greatest LPs of the modern era, including Oasis and people like that, have recorded their music.
Yeah, it's actually in Monmouthshire, which my father always used to say, that's not really Wales.
Right.
You know, there was a dispute down the years as to whether Monmouthshire was in the Welsh country. Abergavenny is in Monmouthshire. I have been to Rockfield Studios, actually.
Have
there's
it?
Not just one, there are several.
Right.
But it was the first residential recording studio in the world.
Yeah.
And
what does that mean?
It means that you go and live there while you're recording.
Right.
So you don't just turn up for the day and do, you know, a bit of recording.
Yeah.
You actually move in,
yeah,
and you all live there, sleep there, eat there, and you record your album sort of over time. Albums used to take months to record.
Yeah.
But of course, now you can make an album in a week. And this is mainly the reason why the studios are all closing down. So Abbey Road is clinging on, isn't it? But Olympic Studios, Trident has gone, Red Bus, all those famous studios of yore.
Yeah. Why are they closing down?
Because of digital technology. You know, we can make an album in a bedroom on a laptop,
right,
nowadays.
Yeah, but surely they need the acoustics, don't they? They, you know, the room's got to be fitted out, just like you and I need to record in a studio that's properly fitted out for sound. Surely that applies even more so to music, doesn't it?
All of that can be faked,
yeah,
sort of in the post-production process, yeah. But the reason Abbey Road still goes primarily is because they have the vast studios to accommodate orchestras. You know,
yeah,
and if you're going to record orchestras live, you still need a big space to put them in.
Yeah.
Do you know the first big hit that was recorded at Rockfield?
Yeah. No, I don't.
I hear you, I Hear You Knocking by Dave Edmunds Rock Pile. Oh, do you remember that?
That's right. Was that the first number one? I hear you knocking, but you can't come in.
That's the one.
Yeah.
And of course, the biggest claim to fame was that Bohemian Rhapsody was mostly recorded there.
Was it? Wow.
The greatest pop song of all time.
Yeah, well, some would say, absolutely, including yourself. That's really fascinating stuff. Dave Edmunds, by the way, I mean, he was knocking around when I was a kid, and he'd make a record and then disappear for, you know, like years, and then another record. And everybody said he was a genius, but he kind of never really made it, did he?
Well, within the industry, he's considered to have made it.
Yeah.
You know, he's a very, very nice man, very respected guy.
Yes.
He's knocking on a bit now. He must be about 80, I would
guess. I suppose
guess.
So, yeah. I hear you knocking, but you can't come in.
Yeah.
What was the other one he made? I Knew the Bride. I Knew the Bride when she used to rock and roll. That's right, isn't it?
I tell you what, he's a genuine Welshman as well. So always such lovely company.
Is he?
Dave
is he? Right, yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I'm not knocking him. He made some good records in those days. Now, I tell you what I was going to talk to you about, Leslie Ann, talking about songs and records and all that. A new report from the University of Westminster says that your musical taste in life is shaped by records that you hear from the age of 10 to the age of 30, and then after that you don't get any more influential musical input or like anything else after that age. And for me, that is absolutely true. In fact, for me, it was from the age of about 10 to about, I would say, 21, and I didn't really listen to much after that.
Well, no offence to my alma mater, my former university, Westminster was where I studied, but well, duh, you know, it doesn't need a study to tell us that.
Yes.
The music we hear and relate to between the ages of 10 and 20,
yes,
which is the most profound developmental period of our lives,
yes,
it's fundamental and pivotal, and all those heritage bands with ancient audiences all reliving their youth sort of back this up,
yeah,
as we spoke about before.
Yeah.
You know, you go along and see the Eagles, look around the audience, and it's a massive sea of grey.
Yeah.
You know, people do stick in their musical time because that's the music we wake up to. Mm. We develop so rapidly between the age of 10 and 20, and we cling to our music as a sort of salvation.
Yep.
Our music is always the kind of music that our parents hate, and we all go through that. So I don't relate to the music that my kids are switched on to right now, and that's probably absolutely right, because our music should be for our own generation.
Yeah, no, I totally agree.
I think they've spent a lot of money finding out what we knew already.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. Some of these research missions could be called stating the bleeding obvious, but I totally agree with you. I mean, even though I'm sure there is great music around, which I've never bothered to listen to, by bands like Coldplay, you know, and things like that, I'm just not interested. My head is musically full of everything I want to hear. And if I just lay on my couch all day and just switched onto YouTube or Spotify or something like that, I would have hundreds and hundreds of records I could get through before I got bored and wanted to listen to anything else. So I don't know whether that has closed off my mind to new opportunities musically, or whether I've just found, you know, this sort of nirvana of musical paradise.
Well, you know what you like,
yeah,
Mike, and you found your happy place.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right, indeed. Right, Leslie Ann, well, thank you very much indeed, and thank you to all of you who have been listening. Always a great pleasure. Leslie Ann, when people want to get a hold of you, where do they go?
On Twitter at LAJWriter.
Absolutely right, and I'm Mike Parriott on Twitter and planetporkypod@gmail.com, and had a few tweets from the last podcast, Leslie Ann, from people taking the mickey out of me getting it so badly wrong last time, but
it was one tweet I saw which made me die laughing. It was very interesting. The guy had combined all the various bits of
exactly
email addresses that you had stated and put them all together, which was hilarious. Well done.
Yes, it was rather hurtful, but I'll get over it.
We're on your side, Michael. We love
you. That's very kind of you. Okay, everybody, thank you very much. We'll listen to you next time. Signing off from Planet Porky. I think I might start a campaign with a local paper, the Chester Chronicle, which I used to work for them to demand that Mike Porky Parry gets an award from Chester University. Do wonders for Chester University, because it used to be a teachers' training college, but like all things in the last 25 years that were technical colleges or teachers' training colleges, they're now amazingly a university. But, you know, there's too many universities in this country already. Anyway.
Well, I think you're pulling my leg, because I think that you wouldn't actually accept an honorary degree. You've got a degree anyway.
I haven't.
No, I thought you had.
No, I did 1 year at the University of the Trent and then copped out because I realised trying to become a chartered surveyor wasn't really my calling. And that's when I left and went and joined the Chester Chronicle, and the rest, of course, is history. I conquered Fleet Street, conquered the airwaves, and now, of course, greatest accolade of all, I'm working with you.
It's for me too. It's just, this is the highlight of my life.
Absolutely.
But, if you really desperately need a degree, Mike, you could work for one with the Open University.
I could do, but that would take too long. I've thought about buying one from somebody in America, because, of course, that's easy enough. Later on, halfway through the show, he appears on the edge of the stage and he's playing the flute. And I looked up, you know, what his qualifications for that were, and apparently he's one of the world's great flatulists. Not flatulists, flautists. But John himself, he was a typical Fleet Street slob.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key, and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.